This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. We've looked at the impact the new cannabis laws may have on public health, and we turn now to public safety. And joining me here in the studio is Gary McNamara. He's the Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. He's also the former police chief of Fairfield. Chief, welcome.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
With your background in a municipal police force and your current position at Sacred Heart, you have two windows, I think, to look into this subject, law enforcement and public safety, although not necessarily mutually exclusive terms, but two somewhat different aspects. What is your impression of the new law that allows adults to use marijuana recreationally?
Well, you know, if I put on my law enforcement hat, mm-hmm. having spent 30 years in law enforcement, it's an adjustment. I mean, you know, we are tasked with enforcing the laws that the government issues. And basically, those laws are really what the community wants and the community standards. So, you know, it's we don't have the option of maybe having an opinion on it. So, you know, we have to be able to move with the flow. So I would, if I was still a law enforcement officer, just have to adjust. I think people have to just understand that 30 years or however long those drug laws were in place, it takes a little while to reset your mind that what used to be illegal is now legal in some components.
What are your biggest concerns as a director of public safety on a university campus? And maybe you can speak from having been in contact with other people in your position on other campuses. What are some of the main concerns that you have in light of this new law?
Well, I first of all, the way we approach it on campus has not changed and will not change currently. We are guided by federal law, and our following is really the Federal Drug-Free Schools and Campus Act, which was originating in 1989. And that basically says the university or any higher education establishment has to have a drug-free campus. So that really will not change. And to put it bluntly, the way in which we handle those cases prior to the change in laws will really remain the same. We're a drug-free campus. In the past, when it was totally illegal, you know, a small amount of marijuana, if a student was found with it, they'd be referred for discipline. That will remain in effect. The only thing that was ever referred for prosecution or for a criminal investigation would be if there was some sort of sales or more of an organizational structure to it. So the way in which we approach it, we're a drug-free campus. We remain a drug-free campus, and it is illegal per se on campus to have that material.
Do you think students, generally college students, understand the new law? I mean, most are undergraduates anyway. Most are under the age of 21. But there are concerns that there will be sort of a trickle-down effect where legal users, now 21 and older, are buying for younger people. We've talked with a number of folks in the public health sector who have talked about that and used alcohol as an example. It's easy for individuals who are not supposed to have it to get it because they know people, they've got siblings, whatever, who can easily go out and buy it and share it.
Well, I do. I think if you look at the history of where we came in Connecticut, we at one point decriminalized it, meaning that it was more of an infraction. And it was still a violation. And I was still in law enforcement at the time. And the general thinking amongst our youth was that it's legal. And so once you get that sense, now I gave you the campus position in all of this, mm-hmm. but that position obviously is going to be tested because as our students realize that it's more acceptable, they kind of forget that there is some standards that remain in effect. And the more availability, the more legal availability to it, to your point, the more likelihood that that will be even more difficult to keep out of the hands of our youth that really shouldn't have it. And that'll be a challenge. It certainly will. Once the word gets out, it's legal. Well, it's legal. It's just like underage drinking. You know, underage drinking is illegal, but we know that it's always a challenge.
You have standards, as you mentioned, that students are expected to follow on campus. Do you anticipate changing those in any way to deal with the, what's the word, the increased temptation to perhaps violate the standards that are in place now?
You know, we always try to do proper messaging, and our messaging will obviously have to adjust to the times. And so in the past, it's pretty easy message. It's illegal, and it's illegal on campus as well. Now we have to re-message that to say that even though it may be legal elsewhere, it's certainly not illegal now. And then, you know, encourage still. You know, I mean, it's important. As our youth come on, they come on as freshmen, they're young, we always want them to make proper decisions in that fine line between growing and going out on your own and still recognizing that you still are pretty young, and some of the information we have could be pretty valuable to keep you on that path to maintain some safety and healthy lifestyle.
So it sounds like there's an education campaign connected with helping students understand just generally about substances like marijuana and about the new law, which makes it illegal. Education beyond read what's in your handbook and do that.
Yeah, we have a pretty robust education program in proper choices around alcohol and drug use and a variety, as you can imagine, of other issues.
Do you anticipate the use will grow among students as the legalization becomes more well? People know more about it. There are no retail sales establishments yet, but come the middle of next year, that's a possibility?
I do. You know, while we'll remain drug-free campus, you know, we're an alcohol-free campus as well, but we know that, you know, alcohol is legal and accessible, so I would imagine as it becomes more accessible, there'll be more of an opportunity or a temptation or decisions being made that will take people in that direction. A lot of times, some people have not chosen to try or use marijuana simply based upon that it's illegal. You know, there are those that say, I have a career, or I don't want to violate a law, even if I don't get caught, in case I'm, you know, drug tested, or I have to go a polygraph for some certain careers, they don't want to have take that chance. And so I do anticipate that, keeping in mind that there are still career paths that will, regardless of whether it's legal or not, will err on the side of this is legal or not, we don't allow it. And if you use it or you test positive for it, we may not hire you for it.
I would imagine for students who live off campus, the temptation is even stronger.
Yeah, we know that, you know, around the property, it's a lot easier to control behavior, and when they get off campus, a lot of times they're older, so they test the boundaries more, and we're limited with what we can do. We also know that freshmen, younger students, you know, we don't keep them here at night, or you know, there's no gates around to keep people in, so you know, they're going to venture out, they're going to make friends, and they're going to do things. So yeah, we're going to in all likelihood, we'll be surprised if we don't see an increase in some of the issues, and we're just going to have to address them and ensure that That's on our mind all the time.
We mentioned that your career stretches back quite a ways in law enforcement, 30 years in the Fairfield Police Department, a number of them as the chief. I'm wondering how much of your work then was connected to the illegal marijuana trade and its use.
You know, I think our officers would encounter it, you know, so that we would encounter it during traffic stops, encounter it during investigations. So our detectives would obviously do some lengthy investigations as it focused on the transportation and harvesting and sales of marijuana. So, you know, it's just a realm of investigations. It probably a significant amount of time in some of our investigations focused on marijuana. And in all likelihood, officers stopping cars were going to find or smell marijuana in the car or encounter juveniles behind buildings using it. So there was some time focused on that.
I want to call you chief because it's so long you were chief. But Mr. McNamara, Chief McNamara, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you always for having me.
Gary McNamara, the retired chief of Fairfield Police and the executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. We continue with a look at public safety in the light of the new marijuana laws and what governments are doing to accommodate the legal sale and use of cannabis in their jurisdictions. Sergeant Joseph Dino from the city of Norwalk is with us on the phone to talk about the new laws from a police perspective. Sergeant Dino, hello and welcome to the full story.
Good morning. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Certainly. I guess, you know, maybe we shouldn't use the word new because the law's been around for just about 6 months now. I'm wondering, prior to the change in the law, what was the situation with illegal use of marijuana in Norwalk and I guess the sale of it as well? Was it a big problem? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think like any, you know, municipality our size, we do have the illegal use and sale of marijuana. I wouldn't say it was horrible, but I can't say it also was not non-existent. I would say about average for a city our size.
And when it became evident that there would be a change in the law, recreational use of marijuana by adults 21 and older would become legal, and the sale, although points of sale have not really been set up just yet, but the sale of marijuana would also become legal. Did there need to be a change in the way Norwalk police would approach marijuana to accommodate the new law?
Well, you know, not so much a change because it's basically a stop of actions, if you will, if that's the correct way of saying it, as far as enforcing that, because it's no longer illegal. So it was more just a change of learning, a new mindset. For up until now, for my entire career anyway, it had always been illegal. So, you know, it was just a change of mindset, realizing, well, if it's not illegal, we can't enforce it anymore.
How easy is it to change mindset? I assume you're talking about officers. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's like anything else. I think it's officer or, you know, the private public. And I say that because when you're used to doing something, you know, for so long and all of a sudden it changes, whether you agree with it or not, you have to take that change, especially, you know, in our position where if something is not illegal, we can't do anything about it, so to say. I don't know if that's the best term to use. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, it's part of the law. It's a change in the law, and we have no choice, and we can only enforce the laws on the books. As from, like, you know, talking to the public and different members of the public and private persons, I think there are a fair amount of people who also maybe are having a hard time with that. And the reason I say that is it started to the frequency to slow down a little bit, but we continued, you know, after the change in law to get a lot of phone calls. As always, you know, this person is maybe using marijuana in this location or that location. And, you know, the public would call us and we would go and investigate. If there was a violation of law, we would take action on it. But now, you know, we find ourselves having to explain to the caller that, you know, sir, ma'am, it's no longer illegal, so we can't take enforcement action on it. And many times the person would become, you know, upset or like maybe in disbelief, and that's definitely understandable. But, you know, it's hard from that point of view.
So to some extent, the new law does make it necessary to change how police interact with the community members in Norwalk.
Well, I would say from the point that, you know, now if someone is using marijuana and it fits the parameters of the new law, we don't take action on it as long as it fits the parameters. And that's just the way things are.
Does the new law make it easier or harder for police officers to do their work when it comes to dealing with people using marijuana?
I don't think it makes it harder, easier or harder. I think it's a change. You know, it's a change in what we did in the past for, you know, as long as memory serves.
What about the illegal marijuana trade? Will the new law that makes it eventually legal to sell to the public recreational marijuana to adults, will that somehow force the illegal trade out of town or, you know, further underground? What do you think about that?
You know, that's a good question, and as I'm sure you can relate, without being able to see in the future, one, you know, really can't say with 100% certainty, but, you know, I found myself in thinking about today's interview, and even before that, you know, when we realized that the law was changing, is the only thing I could possibly relate it to is, you know, when Prohibition ended, and when alcohol was illegal, there was a lot of violence and crime related to that. People kept on consuming, buying and selling. And then, you know, it was changed. And as far as my perception of history, a lot of the violence and crime associated with that seemed to diminish. So that's the only thing that I can liken it to for me personally, you know, as far as my opinion goes. And I don't like to mix personal opinion with this job because, you know, as we talked about before, law enforcement is not about opinion. It's about doing what the law says. So, but I think that's it, pretty much as best as I could possibly relate it to that. You know, it's possible that, you know, any type of crime that you see associated with that maybe will go down because now you can just, you know, or we'll be able to go to a store and purchase it instead of maybe, you know, on the street or street corner and the danger associated with that and persons you don't know. It would kind of be similar to if you're of age to going and buying a pack of cigarettes. And that's just my personal opinion.
I suppose then you could someone could look at the new law as helping public safety as opposed to creating more danger.
That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure.
Maybe too soon to tell, I suppose.
Right. Everyone would have a different opinion, and you're right. It is still, I think, too soon to see what the long-term ramifications of this would be, good and or bad.
Will the city of Norwalk have establishments that will be allowed to sell recreational marijuana to adults, or has some places, some communities have opted out of that?
You know, as far as whether or not that is going to happen, I would have to defer to City Hall, the police department. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't, you know, make decisions on that particular subject area.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, too, about DUIs. How do you test for being under the influence of marijuana? I don't think there's one available yet. What do you do about that problem when it comes to traffic incidents?
Right, so that makes it a little bit more difficult, and that, you know, we would follow procedures, you know, that we always have, you know, driving under the influence of alcohol and or illegal drugs. That's been on the books for as far as I can remember, but it's not the same as testing someone for alcohol. There is no breathalyzer for marijuana use. So, you know, the officer follows the initial field sobriety testing that, you know, you can see some effect on the way the person is acting or reacting to certain things. But, you know, aside of like maybe a blood test, it's very difficult to know, you know, how much a person has in their system. It makes it very difficult.
Yeah, we've been hearing from a number of people who are sort of saying, you know, it's kind of a wait and see with some of this. Just have to see how it plays out before, you know, any sort of concrete conclusions can be arrived at.
Yeah, you know, and it's different for us, you know, implementation-wise, because usually when there's a change in the law, it's usually more restrictive of something. So, you know, what do we usually do in that case? When it's feasible, let's do something like motor vehicle, you know, like let's say a stop sign went in or a traffic light or there's a change to like a speeding or something like that. So when we see an offense, we would stop the person, and if the situation allows, we would give them a warning, you know, just so you know, there's a new stop sign, there's a new traffic light, you know, a speed limit change to this in this area. So, you know, so in the future, please be careful. And that's the way we would do things when possible. But for this, it's, you know, it's different. We can't stop somebody and say, hey, just so you know, you're smoking marijuana. I just wanted to let you know it's perfectly okay now. So it kind of changes things up a little bit.
I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
It's just kind of, we flip the switch off and that's it. And there are to the laws, there are, you know, there's graduations to amounts and ages and stuff like that. But, you know, and there's a section that says we can't, you know, stop someone just because we think that they're maybe driving while smoking marijuana. But then in the section it says except for if the officer sees that. So that part of the law is a little confusing. It seems, you know, at least to me, it's a little contradictory, you know, where it says, like, if a person has over a certain amount of, you know, under a certain amount of money, it's no longer illegal. But if they have over a certain amount of money, well, then it's actionable. But if we can't stop to verify, how do we know? So it's kind of a catch-22, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure it's something that'll get ironed out in future sessions at Hartford.
I think that's a very important observation, especially the part about the different graduations of the law, making some of it illegal, some of it legal. That's important for people to understand.
And it's hard because, you know, we go through and read the law and, you know, we're used to certain wording in it, and a lot of it has to do with age. So, but, you know, like in certain age groups, how do you know someone's 18 or older or younger unless you interact with them? So it's kind of a catch-22, you know, as far as, you know, looking out for the younger population, which I think, you know, for us, that's probably our major concern. If an adult wants to, you know, drink alcohol in excess or use recreational drugs in excess, well, you know, that's kind of, they're an adult, they're a decision type of thing. But, you know, when it comes to youth and children, that we worry about. Because, you know, at that age, they may not have the wherewithal to fully know the ramifications of their decisions. So there is a provision in the law that when we do, you know, come across somebody that is younger like that, we hand them an informational sheet, letting them know the dangers and effects or possible dangers and effects of the use of marijuana on young people. So it's an educational piece, you know, as well. But, you know, that's the concern. There's a lot of concerns, and it's mainly with the youth. And like anything else, let's say, you know, you're in the home with mom and dad or your caregivers, and, you know, you see that they consume alcohol a lot. Well, a lot of times children like to mimic their adults, you know, that are an influence to them. And so the concern is that maybe this will happen too with marijuana use. You know, if let's say, as the phrase goes, little Johnny sees mom and dad, you know, smoking marijuana in the home and it's not illegal, that they maybe feel, okay, I'm going to do that. And, you know, the concern is for their safety and well-being. But that perhaps is the greatest concern, I would say, of all, you know, are the kids with this.
Well, again, Sergeant, thanks so much for your time and your perspective on this. I think it's very important, and we appreciate you spending some time with us.
Absolutely, my friend.
Sergeant Joseph Dinno is from the city of Norwalk. Last week, we talked with the co-founder and co-executive director of the Cattell Center for Equity, Health, and Justice, Lorenzo Jones, and he spoke about the new marijuana laws and how they could change public health in communities targeted by the war on drugs. Now we continue with that interview, and this time the topic is public safety. And share the anecdote that you just mentioned about the racial aspect of that part of the story.
So this is one of those ironic things, and people can argue it. I'll just share my reflection on the experience. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a long, convoluted rationalization like that. Okay. But in reflection and preparation for this interview, a revelation came to me that I had not actually considered before. Okay. Give me a second. What you understand today and what we all understand today as the criminal justice reform movement or the movement to end mass incarceration. And we talk about how that has shifted and expanded and grown since George Floyd and BLM and the Women's March and Trump, right? Mm-hmm. And reactions around that stuff. The thing that dawned on me is that I remember in marijuana reform where marijuana was a white issue. Legalizing marijuana was what white people was doing and black people was joking about. legalize and I'll advertise. It was black people running around like, don't you understand how bad this prohibition is? And Adam and Eve is the first prohibition. And like that was like white people that was doing that. Well, this thing happened where like the Drug Policy Alliance, who I wanted to lift up, right? Mm-hmm. And some other places, Marijuana Policy Project, and some of these places who back then didn't have great racial politics. Undoing racism training hadn't become a popular thing, right? Yet, it was still kind of radical. The Drug Policy Alliance and takes resources, and they specifically, their staff, one of those people being my co-director, Gabriel Ekatal, he works for the people doing this, but there's black leadership inside of the Drug Policy Alliance that names a thing that we now see in macro. And they name the leadership of formerly incarcerated black men, black people, as a priority in leadership to make to have a legitimate, a credible messenger to push back against like this public safety argument of enforcing the drug war. So this is 2002, right? And so an argument is made that an investment has been made in formerly incarcerated people's leadership, right? Which at that time was code for black male leadership, right? Credible black male leadership. An investment had to be made by the drug policy folks in order to build a large enough body politically, locally, to stand, right, and hold accountable these networks of public safety spaces that kind of own the drug war, who like prosecutors used to like, you know what I'm saying, like validate their positions. So if you kind of think about like how that's all working, the drug war ends up being the drug policy reform work, right, ends up being like this dismantling of like this machine that we later come to call and recognize as broken windows, right? By the time we get to Eric Garner. This is really important because the resources and the money, the cash, the checks that cleared, the general operating support grants that supported, that went and invested into like that early leadership of black male and black women leadership, specifically who was formerly incarcerated to do drug policy reform work, that a bunch of that money came from people that on their face we were still calling racist libertarians. Remember, it was libertarian money that was pushing the marijuana stuff. Mm-hmm. It was decisions by places like the Drug Policy Alliance, now led by a whole black woman, an entire black woman, right? Right? That at that time didn't have the racial politics, but had there were organizers and staff on there who understood this, who kind of foresaw this trajectory and this criteria of leadership having to account for formerly incarcerated people. So as you've seen, the formerly incarcerated people's movement, and I don't remember the whole acronym, right? Formerly incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated families, children, right? The whole thing. But as you've seen the leadership of formerly incarcerated people be prioritized in the country, right? You've seen what was the drug policy reform movement turn into the criminal justice reform movement. BLM takes it and expands it further. The Women's March expands it further. Like a bunch of policies under Trump expands it further, and we end up with a movement to end mass incarceration. And now we're at a place where it's like we need to reform the entire police, the law enforcement system. We get there, and most of the people working on that today, including the Koch brothers and all that criminalization language and Ted Cruz and all that stuff, right, is in direct response to formerly incarcerated people's leadership being invested in some ways, the most unlikely space to get not just capital, but like unrestricted capital to do what they saw fit. And you see New Orleans, you see Alabama, you see like South. Now all the foundations join in. And then when Floyd happens more, now we got the Koch brothers and everybody just piles on and Jay-Z, and here we are. it's been amazing. That's all.
Well, how do you see Ekatal's work going forward now? The change in the marijuana laws, the connections that the straight line that you essentially draw back to early 2000s, will that change the work that you do? How do you see your role, Ekatal's role, going forward?
we're much more interested in closing this gap, specifically around marijuana, okay? Closing the gap or continue to fill the space, right, of advocacy to include people who are doing that work through civic engagement, not just straight out, not just advocating for straight state policy. So all politics are local. So at Qatar, the way we see going forward is that, like, we want to be in the best position for whatever happens in 10 years. So our goal is much more about training people to be engaged locally, regardless of what the issue is. We're going to use marijuana policy reform, right, to get people educated and informed on how to fight for it, right, so that when they hear about it, they can't be lied to. The idea for us, success for us over the next, say, 18 months, right, probably has more to do with how many people. We want to train 250 people in civic engagement, understanding local municipal controls, understanding, like, the legislature, election cycles, and so forth. So now, right, when an opportunity presents itself around whatever policy, in this case, marijuana, right, we've actually kind of, like, we stay ready so we don't have to get ready kind of thing. So that's our, right, that's regardless of what the issue is, we're going to do it on bail, we're going to do it on parole reform, we're going to do it on, you know, harm reduction, increase in overdose, and some of the stuff we're partnering with other folks on. So we don't want to act like we're just out here, you know, being great. That's not the case. Like, the most important thing is us finding ways to have effective relationships with other organizations that have credibility and capacity on these issues, and then showing up with what we got and, like, holding a sign sometime. Last thing, most times, especially with the marijuana stuff, the thing that we found effective, because now we have such a wide breadth of people working on it, from whether it's industry or policy side, it's so many people, the ecosystem's so thick. Sometimes we actually see the marijuana work as opportunities for training opportunities and leadership development for our members and our partners, members and our organizers to go participate in events that they don't have to take responsibility for, but they can learn about and they can network and they can build relationships. We then can turn those relationships into political power, right, back, you know what I'm saying, places like the state capitol and city hall.
Mr. Jones, how does mass incarceration affect the mental health of a community?
Right? When we went to people, and we do, see, we organize block by block. So we're at people's kitchen tables, the same way we're at my kitchen table right now, okay? We're at people's kitchen tables. And so when you go to people's kitchen table as a community organizer, don't say, oh, I got a marijuana case, and I got, like, the other case. They say, I got court. They got court, right? And so it's like, what we came to learn was it was not the use of, like, say, marijuana. It's the fact that you are walking home and the police made you pull it out your pocket only to make you set yourself up to get arrested. And so, like, the conversation even about marijuana that came to the table, it's, like, about, like, the misuse and abuse of, like, some of the most vulnerable people in our communities. You see, it's not a big jump when we're having a conversation, not even about marijuana, becomes an opportunity for people to exercise their frustrations around their experiences, like, with this stuff. And at the same time, if we can get people, like, pain relief, appetite inducers, and, like, you know, psychological help, that's as much a priority. We very much have to see this not like organizing for marijuana reform. We have to see this the way we organize for veterans. We have to organize for marijuana reform the way we organize and we build power to change the system and make lives for veterans, right? Like, and now we're back to the question. This is why you got that long rambling answer about the public health stuff. Because now when I say it like that, the public health thing makes a lot more sense to people because we know, like, the homeless population is full of people who are vets. We know that, right? So what's the response to that is housing. Right. Mm-hmm. In some places. Yeah. Right. And it's like, to me, that's the complexity of the marijuana reform conversation.
Mr. Jones, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Lorenzo Jones is the co-founder and co-executive director of the Qatar Center for Equity, Health and Justice. When Connecticut legalized adult recreational use of marijuana, they left it up to local governments to decide if they wanted to opt out of letting cannabis-based businesses open within their borders. And quite a few towns have taken advantage of that part of the new law. We wanted to understand why some municipalities took that stance. The town of Southington, Connecticut, is one of them. And joining me now is Robert Hammersley via Zoom. He's the chairman of the Southington Planning and Zoning Commission. Mr. Hammersley, welcome to The Full Story.
Happy to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. In September, your P&Z Commission voted to prohibit the retail sale and cultivation of marijuana in Southington. I'm wondering, how did it fall to the P&Z Commission to make this decision?
That was a legislative decision. That was what the legislation that was passed in the 2020 session put it on the town's planning and zoning commissions to possibly opt out of recreational sales. So there is a difference: medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. We in Southington allow medical marijuana in a very small part of our town. And we've done that for a number of years. I think before medical marijuana legislation actually passed, we had that in our regulations. With regards to recreational marijuana dispensaries, we decided as a town and as a commission, an elected commission in our town, to opt out of that provision. We also took it a step further, and we don't allow for the cultivation of marijuana, recreational marijuana, in our town as well.
And as someone on a P&Z commission, a planning and zoning, a P&Z commission, I should say, planning and zoning commission, help us understand what it is a P&Z commission actually works with when a project comes to the table, and how the marijuana dispensary situation is something that a P&Z commission has to work with. I mean, beyond what the legislation actually says.
So planning and zoning commissions in Connecticut are regulated by state statute. I believe it's Section 8 of our general statutes that outline our responsibilities. And in a nutshell, planning and zoning is responsible for the land use policies of each of the municipalities. In my case, the town of Southington. And we adopt a set of regulations which kind of set up a framework for what type of development we want and what that development should look like in town. And we adhere to those regulations. Those regulations are something that occasionally get changed as we see fit. So that's our primary piece of guidance, if you will. Another thing that feeds into what we consider is what's called the Plan of Conservation Development. The POCD is also regulated by the state of Connecticut. We're required, every town in the state of Connecticut is required to adopt a POCD and revise that POCD every 10 years. Our last one was done in 2016, so it's about 5 years old. So we look to those two pieces of documents to try to guide us in what we want and what we don't want to have happen in our town and how we want it to look moving forward. So whether it's a development, a housing development, or a commercial development, or industrial development, those are things that are all outlined in our regulations. With regards to recreational dispensaries, that was new coming out of, again, the 2020 legislative session. And, you know, we looked at it and we decided as a town that we didn't wish to have recreational marijuana dispensaries in our town.
Is health and safety, are those things that you consider as a P&Z board when you're reviewing projects, regardless of what type it might be?
It's health and safety. It's, you know, traffic issues obviously play into that. Just sort of maintaining a sense of our historical background a little bit, right? So most towns in Connecticut date back to the 18th century, and you know, we're not an exception to that. I believe we were founded in 1775, we're established in 1775. You know, we have a certain history in our town that we like to appreciate and preserve as best as possible.
Could you give us more details about how the prohibition would work, the prohibition of cannabis-based businesses within your borders? How would that prohibition work? What specifically does it say?
So again, for medical marijuana, we allow medical marijuana dispensaries in our town. We did have an application a couple of years ago. We approved it. They never got their license out of the Department of Consumer Protection, so it never materialized into anything. With regards to recreational marijuana, there's an outright prohibition on recreational marijuana in our recreational marijuana dispensaries or cultivation in our town. So no application could ever be filed for a recreational marijuana dispensary in our town because our regulations don't provide for that.
The vote on the PNZ board was, I understand, along party lines. Five Republicans, including right. yourself, voted to opt out. The two Democrats voted for it. Was there a specific concern or a major concern of the majority when it came to this that brought those five votes together?
Well, I think you touched on it a little bit earlier. I mean, it's health and safety issues, mm-hmm. I think. And I think that, you know, the other thing that's important to understand is that planning and zoning commissions in some towns are elected. That's the case in Southington. And in some towns, they're appointed by either the chief legislative body or the chief elected official. Hartford, for example, is one where their planning and zoning commission is appointed by the mayor. In our town, we run for election every 4 years. I just came off an election last year. And, you know, during those elections, just like any other candidate, we go out there and talk about what we see as important to our town, and the citizens either vote for us or don't. In our town, you know, Republicans have a supermajority on the Planning and Zoning Commission. And so that out of a 7-member board, that gives us 5 members. And there's 2 Democrats. And again, every 4 years, that's revisited by the electorate in Southington as to what they want to have happen.
And I think one of the Democrats on the board said, on the PNZ board, said that the retail sale of marijuana, recreational marijuana, was being demonized.
That may have been, I recall that statement being made, and certainly I appreciate diversity of opinion, and that's someone's opinion. I think that mine is quite different than that.
You mentioned about the history of the town of Southington and many other towns and cities in Connecticut going back hundreds of years. Some of the members also mentioned that they feared this kind of a business could change the character of the town. I'm wondering if you could be more specific about that. What kind of changes would be detrimental to the town?
Well, I think, you know, as a right, we have the, you know, as codified in state statute, as a planning and zoning commission, we have the right to determine what types of developments we want in our town. And we don't allow a number of different developments. Adult-oriented businesses, for example, are not allowed in the town of Southington. It's not to say that we don't have them. We do. But following those being approved, we decided to make a statement and adopt a regulation that prohibits that type of business. With regards to recreational marijuana sales, you know, as a person who lives in town, has lived in town for more than 20 years, and as an elected official elected by the 43,502 people who populate the town of Southington, you know, I felt that it was my obligation to represent them. And personally, I don't think that recreational marijuana sales is something that I would like to see in town. As, you know, in terms of our economic development, I would prefer, and I think the board, by and large, would prefer to see other types of business development, whether it's industrial development, which we love to have, or whether it's some type of retail or entertainment, dining, or that type of thing. Type of development, that's what we encourage, and that's what we work for on an ongoing basis.
I believe another concern that was mentioned, and we've heard this from not just people in Southington, but all over the state and all over the region, too. Another concern was that it could send the wrong message to young people in a community if this kind of a business were to open. Could you sort of connect us with that? What is the message that you think they would get from that kind of a business in town?
So I'm a parent. I have 4 kids. My youngest is 9 years old, and you know I think that people were concerned about, you know, having a business such as a recreational marijuana dispensary in town and getting questions about that and having to try to address that. You know, it's certainly, you know, I respect people feeling that way, and I can see their point. Again, it's one perspective that was taken into consideration when we decided whether we were going to allow for that to happen or to opt out.
I know this isn't necessarily something that a P&Z board could do something about, but Southington residents certainly would be able to travel to other towns where the dispensaries will be allowed, and you know, make their purchases there, and bring them back to town. So the prohibition won't stop that, but like I said, I guess that's not something you could wade into as a P&Z board.
Yeah, I'm responsible for the town of Southington. I'm not responsible for other towns, whether they adjoin us or don't, whether it's Hartford or Meriden or Waterbury or New Britain, all towns that are very close by to the town of Southington. I can only do what I could do. I will say, too, that I think that the best form of government is the one that's closest to home, and that's local government. I think that we're our ear is closer to the ground as to what's happening on the local level in the confines of our town. And I think that we have a responsibility to reflect that. And I think that by opting out, we reflected the general sense of where we were. And quite frankly, I think that the election results from November of this year demonstrate that. We also had, at the same time, simultaneous with our consideration, the movement to have a petition of a townwide referendum, which is also allowed as part of the legislation that was passed last year. And that referendum that failed to get the necessary votes in order to put, or that petition effort failed to get the necessary signatures in order to put that referendum on the ballot. And I think that that too is indicative of the support to opt out. And I was very vocal at the time as to what my intent was. I think that, you know, I did take a straw poll of our commission before we took the actual vote, I think a couple of weeks beforehand, and that was a public straw vote. And I think that that too demonstrated to the people of the town of Southington that we were going to do. We were very transparent about it.
There were some vocal supporters of this opportunity. They looked at it as to establish adult recreational marijuana dispensaries in town. Is this something that could wind up on your desk again, on the P&Z agenda again in the future, or is this something that's pretty much pushed away and can't be redebated?
Yeah, well, our regulations are fluid, as I said earlier, and they could be changed at any time. Any future planning and zoning commission can come in and change them. But the other thing I'd say with regards to the petition and referendum effort, I mean, that's open-ended as well. If enough signatures were gathered to put it on a townwide referendum, that would necessitate a townwide referendum. And just to play it out a little bit, if that townwide referendum went against or was to allow recreational marijuana in our town, would be back on our agenda as to what types of zones we would want to put something like that in.
Mr. Hammersley, thanks so much for your time today and helping us understand why some towns, Southington specifically, chose to opt out of this part of the marijuana law. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to reach out to me, and happy to have been with you, and thank you.
Robert Hammersley is the chairman of the Southington, Connecticut Planning and Zoning Commission. Are you concerned about how the new marijuana laws could affect public safety? Let us know what you think. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.